I'd like to welcome you to this year's Jane Jacobs Lectures, which is sponsored by the City's program at the London School of Economics. And their lectures named in honor of probably the greatest urbanist of the 20th century, whom I regret to say couldn't join us this evening, but she vets all these lectures long distance from Toronto and sends, as always, her good wishes for this series. Tonight we're going to do something a little different than we normally do in this lecture series. Usually we present non-academics speaking about something that bears on the culture or the design of cities. But we decided to avail ourselves of the presence of Ira Katz Nelson to do something which is a little more intense, which is that we will have two lectures this week in which Ira Katz Nelson is going to lay out, rather as a workshop, a set of ideas that he is currently developing for a book. So I very much hope that you'll treat this as the first of two parts of a kind of intellectual voyage, and I will try and arrange in the second part that you can also travel on this by asking Ira many questions tonight, some. I'm sure many of you know who Ira Katz Nelson is. He's probably the leading political scientist who concerns himself with cities at work today. In my mind, he is the quintessential New York intellectual, but he didn't start it in New York. He originally taught at the University of Chicago as professor of political science and wrote brilliantly on the city of Chicago. He then came to New York, where he was the dean of the graduate faculty of the New School, and after that moved to Columbia, where he's, as a kind of penitence, was the academic vice president, and now has returned to his true vocation, which is political science, in the Department of Political Science at Columbia. As I say, these two lectures are a work in progress, and in a way they are work that feeds off of an earlier study of Ira's called Marxism in the City. These two lectures are about liberalism in the city. In the book on Marxism in the City, Ira asked the question why it should be that Marxism, and particularly Marxist theory, should have so little to say about urban form. And in a way, he's returned to that question in talking about liberalism. That is, what could liberalism say about the city, and particularly about the making of the city? He wrote me that one of his concerns in these talks is about how liberalism and multiculturalism might still be reconciled. It's a very contemporary question, and as you'll see in the lectures, it's a question that necessarily has to take us, as it takes Ira, back to the origins of liberalism, and particularly the writings of John Locke. Now, I'm very tempted to give Ira's entire lecture, but I'm going to forbear and let him speak for himself briefly. And if it's all right with you, if you speak for about 50 minutes this time, then we'll have one kind of kickoff question, which is prearranged, and then I'll open the floor to discussion for 20 minutes. You know how planners are. Nothing can be left to chance. So it's really my great pleasure to welcome Ira Katz Nelson to the London School of Economics. It's a pleasure for us, and I hope it will be a pleasure for you.
Well, thank you very much. What could be better for a person with a lifelong interest in cities an affection for urban universities, then to be here at the LSE, introduced so fulsomely by Richard, if with a touch of fiction, and to speak about liberalism and the city in a lecture series graced by the name of Jane Jacobs. Before I move ahead with the remarks I want to make today, I want to tell a historical story, a short narrative that I will come back to at greater length on Thursday. But it's a story, it's a tale that animates the remarks I'm going to make this evening. And it concerns a group of Jews who came to England, to London, from Rouen in 1096 to establish England's first Jewish community. They fled violence they experienced at the start of the First Crusade, violence not at the level of attacks on Jews that took place in German-speaking lands, but violence nonetheless that impelled some hundreds, we don't have precise numbers, and the demographers have been arguing about this question for a long time, impelled some hundreds to move across the Channel to Norman lands, after all, in England. Jews settled in England and lived in England for nearly 200 years until they were expelled, as many of you know, by Edward I in 1290. By then, their population numbers were between 3,000, 4,000, or 5,000. Having diminished from a peak of about 5,000 to 6,000. These Jews were an urban people. They lived in London originally, but moved after 1140 to settle in virtually every English town of consequence at a moment of robust urbanization. And robust urbanization of a very particular kind. A moment, and I'll come back to this point shortly, a moment when cities moved from the status of being administrative and military centers to the status of being quasi-autonomous and quasi-self-governing units governed by urban law. Not, I should hasten to add, not as independent republics, but embedded within the emerging English state as semi-autonomous, juridical, self-governing, self-conscious units. Jews moved into those towns, into more than 40 by the late 12th century, and until 1189-90, experienced the first century of their existence in England, experienced a high degree of security. There were occasional ritual murder accusations, just three or four before 1190. The first, Norwich, 1144. These are accusations that individual Jews committed crimes, typically murder of a Christian child, to extract blood for ritual Jewish purposes. But these were attacks on individuals, not on the community. The first large-scale assault on Jews collectively occurred, as I'm sure you all know, in 1189, especially in 1190. The most notable massacre was in York, where the Jewish community was erased in large measure by suicide, knowing they were going to be killed. But there was widespread violence across England in 1190, but this was violence not sanctioned at all by the crown. The new king was in France, Richard returned, and set about to punish those who had done harm to the Jews, hanging three, expropriating properties of others for daring to assault his Jews. And they were the king's Jews because these individuals had no status in England other than as the king's Jews. They were not integral to or integrated within the feudal social order. Their circumstances changed radically in the 1230s, when town after town, Leicester being the first, expelled these Jews. And ultimately, they were expelled from England as a whole in 1290. I will return to this theme, this tale of with a beginning, a middle, and an end, because the experience I've just summarized all too tersely was an experience that co-varied, I'm not now arguing a causal argument, but it co-varied with the remarkable development of what might be called proto-liberal institutions in the new English cities, towns developing at just this moment. And one question we might well bear in mind, and as I say, I'll come back to this in detail on Thursday, concerns the relationship between the first development in cities of liberal, and I use the word in inverted commas, nobody called them liberal, liberal institutions of consent, representation, elections, free judiciary, and the like, that occurred in those very places that Jews settled in and then were expelled from in that 200-year period. Now, put that in brackets or in a footnote, but think about that story a bit as I talk. Now, a word first, if I may, about Jane Jacobs, because the spirit of her work animates this talk as well. Her book, Death and Life, Great American Cities, literally was given to me as a gift when I graduated secondary school, just a year after it was published. I can still feel physically the excitement of reading that book. I was a New Yorker. The book is about cityscape, of, among other things, of New York. But I was seized by her particular way of writing about cities that combined two features I think represent not only the best kinds of urbanism, but the best kinds of liberal, more generally, best kinds of political thought. And these two characteristics, which so seized me, I didn't know what to call then, but I would call them today, a combination of what the late Judith Schlar has called a liberalism of fear with what John Rawls has called realistic utopianism. What do I mean by this? For Jacobs, the key feature of the city, what made them differ from other sites of human habitation, was that they're full of strangers. It's the comings and goings of strangers that marks modern urbanism. And the bedrock attribute of a successful city, she wrote, is that a person must feel personally safe and secure among all its strangers. But she wasn't at all certain in New York in the early 1960s, which is now written about in the press as the golden age of low crime and safety, but in 1961-62, the only year I was ever mugged in New York, it wasn't widely thought of as a mecca of safety. And the force of her book was to ask, how can cityscape become a place where strangers can meet, bump up against each other, and not kill each other, not commit crimes against each other, find a zone of toleration? And her work was charged with anxiety about that prospect. And in turn, she developed a stance that might well be called, as Rawls calls his own late work, The Law of Peoples, a kind of realistic utopianism, not an imagined utopia distant from daily life, but a kind of utopian thinking close enough to the way we live that it hypothetically could motivate urban actors, planners, politicians, citizens to transform their cityscape in a way that would be consistent with the norms and values she most wished to advocate. That combination of anxiety, charged fear, as it were, and that type of utopianism animates every page of the book, and it animates the best work, including the work of John Locke, which is the centerpiece of this evening's lecture, at its very best. Now, at the center of these lectures stands John Locke. John Locke wrote A Liberalism of Fear. His fear had two dimensions. First, he was desperately afraid of predatory states. States that left their citizens unprotected, unprotected from the state. And his second great fear, he had only to look around Europe in the 17th century, was the fear of religious war, the fear of rivers of blood being shed over questions of the correct way to worship Christ. Locke also was a figure who advanced realistic utopias. That is to say, especially his second treatise, which is sometimes critiqued as too abstract, not touching the ground, thin, disembedded culturally. This is the communitarian critique of Lockean liberalism. Couldn't be more wrong, in my view. Locke's second treatise was deeply engaged in an enterprise of creating a realistic utopia for the new zones of state and citizen, state and society in the early modern period. And any discussion of liberalism and the city must, seems to me, be charged by this duality, the duality one can find in the work of Jane Jacobs, the duality one can find in the work of John Locke. The dualism of realistic utopia and a liberalism of fear. With Locke, we enter the modern world. It's actually a phrase I take from Richard's marvelous chapter on the Jewish ghetto in Renaissance Venice in Flesh and Stone, when he writes about how we might read The Merchant of Venice as showing the way to a world where, quote, freedom lightens culture's burdens. At the end of the play, we have entered the modern world. Now, I'll return to Locke in a few moments, but note that for Sennett, we enter the modern world when freedom lightens culture's burdens. But freedom does more than that as well. Freedom also makes the burdens of culture and the burdens of difference heavier. Lightness and heaviness in cultural terms go together. They're inextricably related. And it is a feature, a key feature of Western multicultural modernity, that freedom both lightens the burdens of culture and freedom makes the burdens of culture more difficult to carry. And that is the core, it seems to me, of the multicultural challenge that Locke and the liberal tradition, Locke especially in the letter concerning toleration, sought to address. Recently, of course, this theme of the lightness and heaviness of the burdens of culture has been placed at the center of much contemporary thought, including in the work of Will Kimlicka, especially in modern liberal thought. And I will return to Kimlicka as well in the next lecture via the story of the Jews and the city, because while I'm deeply attracted to Kimlicka's wish to make liberalism and multiculturalism work together, the lack of urban attention in that book, almost all the empirical cases are about Native Americans in Canada living in very remote places. The lack of attention to the city, the lack of attention to space, and therefore the lack of attention to some key issues of power, inequality, and membership make the Kimlicka book both immensely suggestive and, to my taste, insufficiently satisfying. So it will be to Kimlicka that I also will return. Now, liberalism and the city. both an obvious topic, probably the most obvious topic I've ever myself lectured on. It's impossible to think about liberalism without urbanity and cities, and frankly, it's impossible to think about cities without thinking about the central political and social questions that animate the liberal tradition. But liberalism and the city are almost never thought together. And for me, an emblematic work of that separation is another book that excited me immensely in 1971, this one, published in 73. In 1971, Johns Hopkins Press sent me a copy of a manuscript by David Harvey, Social Justice and the City. It's a great book. It's a dense book. I couldn't put it down. I read it in one sitting. I didn't go to sleep for hours that night. I'd been asked to comment on it for Johns Hopkins because they'd received two readers' reports. One very favorable, one said, don't publish this rubbish. I was the arbiter. Well, I immediately said, publish now. This must appear not just in the English edition, but available in the United States. But that book, you'll recall, divides in two. The first half is called Liberal Formulations. And by liberal, Harvey meant primarily market formulations, real estate markets, housing markets, capital markets, finance markets, markets that shape the city. The conceit of that book was to shift to what he called socialist formulations, in which he built spectacular edifice, Marxist, Marxisant, and Marxist edifice, with which to consider the materiality of the city in ways not accessible via liberal market discourse. And then urban studies were off and running. It was not just Harvey, it was Castells, etc., 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 in the zone of materiality, working class formation, capitalism and real estate. You all know the themes, and some great work was done under that rubric. But liberalism was the other. Liberalism was the empty shell. Liberalism, again, was the thin, the unspecific, the vacuous. Liberalism was not only the thin and the vacuous, but liberalism was the site of false consciousness. Because to be a liberal analyst of the city meant to avoid those subjects that Harvey put front and center. And for a good two decades, most urban studies were, if not Marxist, Marxisant. About a decade after Harvey wrote, another trajectory began to develop in urban studies. A trajectory focused on language, signification, symbolism, animated in great part by various forms of postmodernism. The symbolism of the city, the language of the city, inscribed in space, inscribed in people's lives, inscribed on the body. Brilliant work has been done in this vein, but not with liberalism on the whole as a partner. The two main strands that currently dominate urban studies are without liberalism and the city as partners. And it's an effort to rejoin liberalism and the city that my remarks and the work I'm currently doing are meant to explore. And I hasten to add, really by way of a kind of truth-telling and apology, that although, as Saskia Sassen reminded me, I've been thinking about this question for some time, I've not been thinking about it consistently. And only in the last short period have I tried to think about liberalism and the city more intensively. So these remarks have, and I thank Richard for this, a workshop quality. That's a very kind way to say a certain form of incompleteness and inexactness. Now, the city should not be thought without liberalism. And liberalism should not be thought, indeed cannot be thought, without the city. I've already said how urbanism has proceeded without much liberalism in it, but so too has liberalism. Not just the work of Kim Lucka, think of the great work, the giant work of John Rawls, only at the very end of his writing does he begin to think about cultural hybridity, about the challenge of toleration, about what he calls political liberalism. But the early work, the great work, on a theory of justice is spaceless, placeless, abstract. It is only when he comes down to the issues of multiculturalism that Rawls begins to speak of practical utopianism. But the kind of utopianism in the great text is practical in its way, yet at a remove from that which we can see, touch, and hear, especially in our cities. And there's been an explosion of work in the liberal political tradition since Rawls. It's post-Rawlsian explosion. But it too is largely spaceless. It too is largely without the city. And I think some of its key weaknesses stem from that elision. Liberalism is less deep, less dark, less capable, less imaginative than it would, could, or should be if it engaged with the city. So those are the premises of this talk. And in particular, I'd like to focus on a specific aspect of urbanity, that which Jacobs underscored, the city as a city of strangers. Strangers not only in the sense of transients who come and go because of the dynamism of an urban money economy, or intellectual exchanges, or who come and go to visit central places like cathedrals and town markets, or even new arrivals from the countryside or elsewhere who intend to stay as immigrants. There also are strangers who remain different despite their permanent settlement in the town or the city. Those people may be known even by face and by name to members of the majority, but their ways of life, whether in language, practices, or webs of signification, is uncommon, often deeply puzzling, incomprehensible, or offensive to others. They may appear different or dress distinctly, either by choice or imposition, and they might be confined to particular segregated quarters, either officially or unofficially. Now, Jacobs, you'll remember, said in the sentence I read near the start, that the attribute of a successful city is that a person must feel personally safe and secure on the street among all its strangers. But a bit of a quibble, because the reciprocal is also vital. As an individual and in the group, the stranger must also be safe and feel herself to be so. And this, of course, is not a given. Insecurity always looms in urban settings. Deep human diversity produces distrust, both from within and from without. But it is just the dynamic plurality in city space that provides the main reason individuals and minority groups who are free to choose often select a life marked by urbanity. More than any other site of human habitation, cities must grapple with human pluralism of all kinds, in culture, in population, in religion, in race, in gender, in ethnicity, in sexuality, in interest, in belief, in preference, and in value. How they do so, in part, is the product of the frame, the institutional and ideational frame into which they enter when they come to the city. And it is the character and role of an ambiguous role of liberalism, liberal institutions and liberal ideas that shapes the way they enter, that I wish to address. So it is cities of strangers that provide the sites for these remarks, cities that compress populations and inscribe human differences in social space, even when, as Engels so brilliantly observed for Manchester, there are many mechanisms at work to obscure this heterogeneity from those who wish to flee it. Like Jane Jacobs, I want to know how strangers can live together both safely and above a threshold of toleration at a level at least that which Susan Mendes has called neighborliness. Neighborliness is more than grudging toleration, but less, it might be said, than generous and full mutual recognition of value, the utopia of multiculturalism, which I believe not to be achievable. Cities are places of skepticism and reserve, groupness and particularity, as well as compression and cosmopolitanism. For strangers to live together and confirm their diversity as an attraction and a strength, all the while reserving their right to particularity, reserve and skepticism and the other, does not require multiculturalism in its fullest measure, but it does require a particular kind of liberalism. Now allow me to turn to John Locke. But first I want to observe that this question of culture, membership, inclusion, neighborliness, toleration within the liberal tradition has been the tradition's most difficult question. Each of the ways liberalism has approached membership, toleration, and neighborliness contains sources of deep practical and moral ambiguity, and thus a great deal of tension. Every liberal regime must define eligibility. Which people, which practices, which cultures will be eligible for toleration, neighborliness, inclusion, and on what terms? What is the scope of the society within which norms of toleration and neighborliness extend? This is a question of civil and residential rights. Who is allowed entry to membership in political society? What criteria should or will be used to grant eligibility to participate in the polity as a subject or as a citizen? And third, will the particular characteristics and commitments of all participants and all groups of participants in a heterogeneous civil and political society be accorded equal regard and recognition? What might that mean? These issues, of course, gnaw at us today. And they gnaw at us today even in the centers of urban liberality like London, New York, and Amsterdam. Now, I should be clear, it's already clear, but I just want to say that I'm not talking about liberalism and the city everywhere. I'm talking about Western cities. And in particular, for the remarks this evening, I'm talking about cities in the northwest quadrant of Europe, and even more particularly, cities on this island, not without reason. Having observed that, however, I would like also to observe that the themes of liberalism and the city today have burst their bounds. They've burst two kinds of bounds. First, they've burst the bounds of urban living in the West. There will soon be more people living in the city of Bombay than on the continent of Australia, is the way Sekhetu Mehta opens Maximum City, his panorama of Bombay. But the urban has burst the bounds of the city itself with the vast speeding up of information, communication, movements of people, ideas, capital, and technologies for war and violence, and with a near end to cultural isolation. The collision of people, ideas, and interests in shared global space has become inescapable, irrespective of whether we live in cities as such. Of course, the city maintains and retains its own special concentration of these elements. New York and London and other great cities about which Jane Jacobs wrote continue to possess a special intensity, vibrancy, and danger in their ties linking family, friends, neighbors, and strangers. But with all the world having become urban, the problems centered on liberalism and the city are now global in reach, no longer fully contained in their traditional agglomerations or confined to their places of origin, the places of which I will speak. Paradoxically, understanding liberalism and the city has become more, not less, vital. Now, to Locke. Let's listen to Locke. There are many companions on the road to modernity, but in political terms, the prince of liberal modernity is John Locke. He's a unique figure who found words, sometimes abstract and remote, sometimes, in the letter concerning toleration, tactile and immediate, that could shape and give shape and expression to the developments that had transformed the political imaginary of Western persons over the course of some six prior centuries. Capturing these developments, most of which were either urban or inconceivable without the dynamism, money economy, initiatives in self-government, and zones of pluralism and freedom that the burgeoning towns and cities contained and promoted. Locke's liberalism is an urban liberalism from start to finish. And once he codified it and made it a revolutionary doctrine, the dynastic worlds of kings and the worlds of feudal and neo-feudal aristocrats began to crumble. With Locke, we truly have entered the modern world. So let's listen a bit to him. First from the letter concerning toleration, 1689, then from the second treatise of government. I'm going to read 22 sentences in all to give as concise a sense as I can in his words of the elements of this leap to modernity, this combination of what I was calling a liberalism of fear plus a reasonable utopianism. And then I'll turn briefly to the urban provenance of these ideas, urban of a particular kind, and comment on his political theory as practical reason. From the letter, bear with me. I esteem it above all things to distinguish exactly the business of civil government from that of religion, and to settle the just bounds that lie between the one and the other. Clear separation of zones, the secular and the religious. Two, joining together of several members into this church society is absolutely free and spontaneous, i.e. membership in a religious association is now conceptualized as a free and spontaneous act within civil society, not a compulsory status. Three, puts upon us a necessity of deliberating and consequently allows a liberty of choosing that which upon consideration we prefer. The idea here of rational deliberation by rational individuals who then are free to choose. Four, what I say concerning mutual toleration of private persons differing from one and another in religion, private persons. There must be a distinction between public and private. Every church is orthodox to itself. Every church is orthodox to itself. To itself, but not to others. The church itself is a thing absolutely separate and distinct from the commonwealth. The business of the laws is not to provide for the truth of opinions, but for the safety and security of the commonwealth, not defined as truth of opinions. There are two sorts of contest among men, the one managed by law, the other by force. And these are of that nature that where the other ends, the other always begins, the dichotomy of law and force. There is only one thing which gathers people into seditions and commotions, and that is oppression. Let those dissenters enjoy but the same privileges in civils as his other subjects, and he will quickly find that those religious meetings will no longer be dangerous. The way to cure the danger of religion is by separating state and religion, and by allowing the freedom of opinion. It is not the diversity of opinions which cannot be avoided, but the refusal of toleration to those which are of different opinions that has produced all the bustles and war. Those are not at all to be tolerated, however, he says, who deny the being of God. So this is toleration with limits. Now, if we acknowledge that such an inquiry may not be done unto a Jew, as to compel him against his own opinion to practice in his religion a thing that is in its nature indifferent, how can we maintain that anything of this kind may be done to a Christian. That's a complex sentence, but he's saying, in effect, if we allow Jews to worship freely, and that implies England then, after the return of Jews in 1655 by Cromwell, Jews could worship freely, then how can we deny the right to free worship by another Christian? And that speaks also of boundaries and of ambiguity. We'll see next time in the way in which Locke thought about and treated the Jewish question. And now, more briefly from the second treatise. For it is to be asked, what security, what fence is there in such a state against the violence and oppression of the absolute ruler? What boundaries, what fence, what protections exist in the state against a predator who is the ruler? The end of law is not to abolish or restrain, but to preserve and enlarge freedom. Law, in its true notion, is at the direction of free and intelligent agents. You already hear the same themes we heard in the letter. Just a few more. Men, being by nature all free, equal, and independent, no one can be subjected to political power without his consent. When men consented to make one community or government and make one body politic, wherein the majority have the right to act and conclude the rest, that is, there's a majority right. I'll skip some, but just let me read two more. The legislative power is that which has a right to direct how the force of the commonwealth shall be employed for preserving the community and the members of it, representatives chosen for a time by the people, afterwards return to the ordinary state of subjects. Temporary political power. And finally, the only reference to cities. I'm claiming this is urban theory all the way down, so I looked and looked and looked and found one sentence. He's describing the second stage of the state of nature. They incorporated and settled themselves together to build cities. And then, by consent, they came in time to set out the bounds of their distinct territories and agree on limits between them and their neighbors and by law within themselves. There is, in his lineage, moving from a state of nature to a state of civil and political society, a movement through urbanization, through cities. Now, here in these quotes are all the key elements in the tradition of political liberalism. First, note that liberalism is a statist doctrine. Its premise is the existence of the state against which there must be protections, but also a state which, through political representation, legislative action, elections, temporary office holding, becomes permeable to the plural interests of civil society. Here we also have heard about juridical equality of subjects, constitutionalism and law, rights to protect against predation, popular sovereignty and consent, the centrality of political representation as an idea and an institution, as I've said, to insert the preferences of civil society inside the state, the role of election and temporary office holding, the toleration of ideas, people, religions, cultures, requirements for membership, including membership in a community of reason and the capacity to reason, all within the theory of Locke's social compact to secure these ends, made possible in his abstract formulation when humankind incorporated and settled themselves together to build cities. Now, this may be his only explicit reference to the urban, but every single one of these principles is based on a set of material, historical conditions and premises which are and were thoroughly urban. Now, what were these assumptions? They were almost entirely assumptions about what some sociologists would refer to as differentiation, or the separation of spheres. Let me count just a few of the separations we've heard Locke talk about. The state is separate from property, money, and capital. The state is separate from civil society that itself constitutes the political community. A ruler is separate from state institutions. The community is distinguished from the rational individual. The religious realm and its doctrines are distinguished from the secular realm and its laws. The public and private spheres are rendered as distinct. Members are distinguished from strangers or outsiders. And dominant opinions, beliefs, and practices are distinguished from dissenting beliefs, opinions, and practices in a pluralistic world. All these conditions of differentiation, all these ideas about differentiation, are intimately bound with the development of modern towns and cities beginning in the 11th century. These are the zones where one can find these distinctions and separations. Nowhere else in the main, and I add in the main with a footnote, and we could talk about the rise of parliament and the nature of representation by barons and knights and so on, but we're not going to do that. I'm not going to do that now. The production of urban space itself was authorized by charters, mainly conferred by kings, that entailed in their language the very separations and concepts I've mentioned from Locke, if in primitive and preliminary form. And they made possible the development of a relatively autonomous zone within which these distinctions could be developed and could be elaborated. The conjunction, density, and differentiation inherent in towns that were not just administrative centers for the king and the central state, but as I noted, were also not independent republics either, embedded both within the reach of the sovereign and embedded in a feudal society and economy from which they were partially exempt. That is, they were embedded in state sovereignty, and the cities were also embedded in feudalism from which they were only partially exempt. The medieval town was honeycombed with a multiplicity of spaces, occupations, groups, class positions, religions, insiders and outsiders, core members and pariahs. Medieval towns were sites for the regulation of space and boundaries, the distinction between both public and private. And there was not just one public sphere or one private sphere, but a jumble of public and private spheres, a heterogeneity of spaces. And these towns were also zones with distinctions between the church and a more secular realm, even under the total hegemony of Christianity. This was a world of a pluralism of social forces and sites of institutional flexibility and experimentation by relatively free legal subjects. What they produced in town governments, in patterns of representation, in demands on the crown for rights, in putting religion in its place, in managing conflict, in defining criteria for membership, later was appropriated from the town experience as a matter for national political communities, national communities that came later to face in a more holistic way the political problem of deep pluralism, especially after the rise of commerce and a capitalist money economy on a national and global scale, and after the end of the Christian monopoly possessed by the Church of Rome. The 6 centuries before Locke published his great texts, and these texts, you know, were both published, the Second Treatise and the Letter Concerning Toleration, were published anonymously because of their radical qualities. The 6 centuries before he published those texts were a moment in England, as elsewhere in the north and west of Europe, of remarkable urbanization. As early as the mid-14th century, on the eve of the Black Death, some 6 of Europe's 60 million inhabitants, that is 10%, lived in towns. Especially in England, the most developed state of all, with the most modern characteristics of integration, communication, and administration, towns became proto-liberal regimes. Unlike Otto Gierke's 1868 text on German laws of fellowship that contains a romantic and communitarian story about the modern city as rooted in fellowship, Max Weber's writings on the city, the jumping-off place, modern jumping-off place, almost contemporary jumping-off place, for a reasoned consideration of liberalism and the city, stress the character of their political growth and their standing as public corporations with legal personalities, as sites of freedom, rationality, and individualism, as self-governing political entities, as loci that saw the development of law and rational legal systems to manage and settle conflicts between individuals and groups. There's a very nice discussion of the character of these conflicts in Quentin Skinner's two volumes on modern political thought. These were conflicts within cities as economic units, as promoters of social welfare, and as political units. And Weber stressed how different these cities were from Roman, Islamic, and Asian cities that had remained mainly administrative or military centers. Because the new town governments lacked repressive instruments, they depended on voluntary obedience and consent, and they seemed to have achieved it, given the scarcity of demands or rebellions. Now, what I'm going to say in the last 7 minutes of this talk is animated by the superb book Saskia and I were discussing before the lecture by Harold Berman, Law and Revolution, The Formation of the Western Legal Tradition, which was published in 1983, and to my knowledge, not much read amongst urbanists, or for that matter these days, anybody else. And there, of course, are a great number of familiar territory to many historians. Think of the work of, going back to the 1930s, of Carl Stephenson on Borough and Town, A Study of Urban Origins in England. And he did a PhD thesis with Henri Pirenne. Or more recently, Susan Reynolds' work, Introduction to the History of English Medieval Towns. There's lots of literature, but it's unintegrated into the kind of considerations about liberalism and or the city of which I'm speaking. Now, the remarkable demographic, spatial, and economic growth of cities and their differentiation went hand in hand with developments in government and law in these urban centers. Municipal charters contained written guarantees in their grants of privileges, including personal liberty, freedom of movement, rights to royal protection, courts and judicial organization, taxing powers, commerce protected by law, and rights to a plurality of occupations, associations, and peoples who could self-govern under the umbrella of representative governments, normatively linked by a distinct and place-specific urban consciousness. My, that was a long sentence. Linked by roads and bridges, moreover. It's a wonderful new book, whose some of you will remember the author on 13th century English bridges. It's a stunning work. In any event, linked by roads and bridges, there was an urban network that was partially independent from feudal landed relations. These cities had distinct legal and political characters, with popular and municipal institutions separate from those of the national state. They also, as Berman stresses, were secular sites, governed by secular law, not church law, but secular law, independent of the church. Even, as I noted, cities themselves were integrated by the routines and rules of Christendom. Movement from military and official centers in 1066 to semi-independent zones of political right and experimentation was the hallmark of English and some other medieval cities. Modern liberalism was born in these cities and was generalized from them to a more rights-based and parliamentary national polity that took place in England during the national rebellions of the 13th century. Urban law, as Berman stresses, was distinct not only from church law, but from feudal law, from mercantile law, from manorial law. It was territorial, secular, constitutional, and representative, marked by civil rights and the delineation of distinctions between citizens, strangers, and enemies. It governed a community marked by a pluralism of communities. And it was to this world, the world as it was forming, that Jews arrived from Normandy at the end of the 11th century. fleeing crusading violence in Rouen. So it is that story that I wish to take up next time, but not alone, not as a freestanding historical tale, but in tandem with three other considerations. First, I'll return to my hero, as it were, John Locke, to examine how Locke thought about the Jewish population that had returned to England after 1655. Were they, could they be, members of a liberal civil society or not? Could they, should they be tolerated or not? Should they be allowed to stay for a long time while professing a non-Christian faith? Or should they principally be objects of conversion? We will see in Locke the multiplicity of themes, the full panorama of possibilities that liberal theory offers us in terms of its treatment of urban pluralism. And then I'll turn to recent work, especially, as I've noted, the work of Wilt Kimlicka, whose subject is identical to that of Locke on toleration and Locke on the Jews. What is the capacity that liberalism possesses to deal with deep human plurality and deep cultural difference? And if it does have some capacity, how might that capacity be organized, both at the level of ideas and at the level of institutions? And very briefly, much more briefly than the discussion of Locke and Kimlicka, I'll say something about the last works of John Rawls, who is the John Locke of our time. And finally, I'll conclude taking the privilege of this podium with what might be called a programmatic, hortatory emphasis to try to persuade you of to embrace an agenda of questions that is not an alternative to the urbanism of signification or the urbanism of historical materialism, but which, together with those impulses, a focus on liberalism and the city, can produce a richer, deeper, more capable urban studies, one that can speak more directly than our urban studies have to date to the most fundamental problems that vex us at the start of this new century. Thank you very much.
Thank you for a wonderful talk. We have one trick, not trick question, but one prepared question, and then I'll throw the floor open. So you have a longish question, Saskia, in the guise of...
It was either a prepared question or a trick question.
No, trick this, not.
We're just married, that's the problem. We don't necessarily communicate. If I would have been just a colleague, I would have received a formal... No, this is a question that really comes out of your talk, which I enjoyed enormously. And it is about three elements: liberalism, as you present it, the civic, and the outsider. And your beginning story is actually a very interesting story, that as these cities develop, they, on the one hand, with the Jews, right, they receive the Jews, and then eventually they expel the Jews. Let me throw at you a little thesis that I have sort of been playing around in my own head in thinking about the question of immigration in European cities today. So the thesis is that because European cities have taken their civics seriously, the outsider is always a big deal, a very problematic character. If you want to simplify the matter a bit, in the United States, we have laissez-faire. Let's call it liberalism light, you know, as in Coke light. So laissez-faire, you can do what you want. And do what they want, they do, so to speak. The difference in Europe is that as the centuries go on, the civic is more and more developed, which every time again raises the ante vis-a-vis the outsider. That then leads me to a second thesis, and that is the question of liberalism and the city. And as I was hearing you speak, you know, I really began to think about this. To what extent is liberalism, much as its origins might lie, and I completely agree with your reading, in the experience of the city, in those borderings, in those differentiations, etc., where, if you want, the not being subject to religious authority is the same as today being protected from the state. You know, we can sort of find the equivalences. But to what extent is, in fact, liberalism, once it enters, I don't know if to call it the capitalist space or the space where you have a central state, a very peculiar condition in the sense that it works when it's light. I mean, L-I-T-E, all right? Let the markets be, let this, let that. We adopt a few new laws, so we have also the blacks, they can all that. But that when it enters the space of the city, which is a very, it is a space that contains the differentiations, that contains the diversities, that contains the necessary intersections, liberalism actually runs into trouble. Because you either have a perfect civic condition, and then it would be fine, it would be a gloss, or you have a situation where the if you want, the norms of liberalism enter into very problematic terrain. And ironically, this is a third sort of little thesis in there, it's precisely the strength of the civic, which yes, derives from liberalism in some way, but I would like to distinguish, which sets, if you want, raises the level of difficulty for liberalism to become a functioning liberalism. So what do you have? You have the liberalism of fear, and you have real, what did you call it? The
realistic utopia.
Exactly. So where then is liberalism?
Not a small question, Saskia. Let me just make one observation, which is to the side of yours, but it bears on it. Many immigrants today, not all, but many immigrants in Europe, whether from the Islamic world or from Africa, sub-Saharan Africa or elsewhere, have a status not very different from that the Jews enjoyed in England, the very conditional status they enjoyed and the rights-less status they enjoyed in the 11th and 12th, 13th centuries. I'm not even putting a value on this. I'm just describing. In some cases, they choose just to come to that status, knowing full well what it is and what its risks are, because it's better than what they have. So that it's the other side of your observation, which says that the thicker the civic, the more likely to exclude. Reciprocally, many who come to thick civic places don't anticipate inclusion in quite this way. So you have, but yeah, their vulnerability and their heterogeneity challenges the liberal tradition even in more ways than you just enumerated. I want to just identify one and then let's go to other questions because I need to think about your reflections some more. In one of those 20-odd sentences I read from Locke, he talked about the rational qualities of the deliberative actor. And it seems to me the one, there is nothing in the liberal tradition, nothing about qualifications for membership. That's inherently liberalism. Liberal ideas have always been located, or to use a jargony word, embedded in sets of current conventional understandings. So it was as night follows day that women weren't at one point to be eligible to be full political participants. It was evident as night follows day, as Mill put it, that backward peoples weren't yet ready to be liberal citizens. But what joined at a more abstract level all these cultural specificities, as it were, was the shared, the one commitment of boundary was the commitment to capacity to reason and deliberate. So what marked those excluded was the sense, not just by liberals, but by others at the time, that group A, group B, group C, group D simply were not qualified because they had not reached a standard of rationality. And that standard seems to me is one that the liberal tradition cannot do without, or else it's too integral to the fabric of the liberal tradition. You can't just take it out. And that raises then deeply today, as in the past, questions of boundaries and content of rationality, how kind of philosophical anthropology of liberalism, if you were. And second, as Rawls discusses in his most recent, his last work, how liberalism should deal with not just peoples, but polities and situations which perforce are non-liberal. And that question, I need not say out loud, is central to our time.
Questions? Comments?
Barbs.
Well, let me pose, let me pose a question. I don't know how many of you have this sense, which is that in some way the prospect of what the freedom of the city lies somewhere beyond the issue for people who live in a city of its form of government. That is to say that what Ira has shown is a kind, if you like, a kind of realistic utopia, but that for urbanites, it's essentially the notion of being ungoverned, the complexity of the city that releases people from the capacity either to participate or to be controlled, which constitutes freedom in a city. And that, it seems to me, is an issue that in some way the freedom is greater, if you like, than this liberal formulation of how to marry difference and the self-directing state.
It's a really rich observation. The freedom, you said, is greater. I would say freedom may be greater. That is to say, I actually don't quite agree that it's given, it's inscribed within the freedom itself is inscribed in the urban form, because it is possible to organize cities in ways that increase surveillance, the very notion, for example, of modern police forces in the 19th century was that of penetrating into an otherwise obscure set of zones of living in order to identify deviants and to punish those who departed from central norms. So there's a dialectic here, which, but I take the point, is wider in its arc, in its swing, than that which liberal political thought has made most central to its own consideration.
If you are an illegal immigrant, the place you want to go to is a city.
Certainly. You don't want to disappear in the city.
Absolutely. If you were a sexual deviant, if you were a religious heretic, you would want to go to that place. Your freedom is greater than the sphere of, I think that's the kind of issue, the kind of boundaries of liberalism to deal with the question of freedom seem to me.
But because I'm interrupting, but
no, sorry,
we're both New Yorkers, as it were.
Really, so
because that freedom is imminent in the city, attempts at control and repression appear very powerfully from time to time, whether it's against alcohol, for example, or the prohibition movement in America, or the control attempts in 19th century American cities to confine the publicness and the public speech of the Catholic Church, to make sure there was no influence in the public sphere, including its schools. So I agree with you, yes, of course. More space, more freedom, but also the temptation of authorities to go beyond that which liberal theory would allow by means of repression.
Well,
Robin?
Oh, wait, can we take a question in the back? Yes.
I was wondering, in your readings of John Locke and further, would you see the formation of ghetto and
the formation of
how would you see the formation of ghettos and in a city which is liberal? Do you see a relation between these two, or does one negate the other?
That's actually a question I'll talk about at a bit of length next time. But the question, as I would reinterpret it, but correct me if you think I'm wrong, is can this Lockean liberal tradition coexist with a spatial arrangement which in part is characterized by compulsory segregation, which is what we mean by ghetto. The uncomfortable answer is yes. If and when the boundary between those inside and outside, say, a particular set of barriers, could be walls, could be invisible, when the definition of who's in and who's out is consistent with the definition of who is rational and who is not. Indeed, the Western liberal tradition has recurringly shown itself wholly capable of living with this contradiction, but living with it as, in, if I may use Maoist language, as a non-antagonistic contradiction. The great work of Gunnar Myrdal, for example, in 1944, An American Dilemma, said this was an impossible contradiction for Western liberalism. Deep racism and often inscribed in racial segregation, and liberalism, which he saw as the core American set of values, Western set of values. But this was it's not persuasive. And one has only to read recent published work on British in Kenya at the end of the period of colonial rule and the kind of treatments of the other that were performed by liberal regimes. Or one has only to think about the American Republic, my country, which is undoubtedly the purest Lockean liberal regime ever created, created by making all those rights Locke spoke about and political representation, as in the supremacy of the legislature in a separation of powers of system, the hallmark of the polity. But it was a slave republic. So that there has been, at an abstract level and at the level of practice, there has been the liberalism does not preclude these exclusions based on race or other characteristics. Having said that, there's also no question that the Myrdalian impulse had truth to it, namely that the other, whether the colonized or the slave, demand Lockean rights, Lockean participation, Lockean representation. The tools of rebellion are the very tools and terms that the liberal tradition has thrown up. And not always, but happily, a fair amount of the time over the last century or so, barriers once seen as natural as the air we breathe to white Westerners no longer exist.
We're going to take two or three questions together, and then
I get the last word.
You get the last word, so please.
I have two observations. They're both connected to the title. As much as liberalism is about citizenship and consent, the first question is really to do with your story. Thank you.
Okay. Yes. Shout.
Yes, I will.
No, shout and be brief. Final question. These are all simple questions, you know. We'll, about midnight, we'll go out for a... Good question. Okay. Well, welcome to the LSC.
Excellent. I'm going to start in the middle with, in a way, the most, among these, all these issues, the most vexing of questions, the issue of multiculturalism. What I wanted to say was that there is a kind of utopianism of multiculturalism, which hinges on the notion one can find in many communitarian writings of recognition, in which, just contrast the word toleration, which sometimes implies I'm prepared to tolerate that which I think is odious, from recognition, which is I recognize what you think, believe, care about as equal to what I think, care about, and believe about. And it's that latter multicultural ideal I think is difficult to impossible to achieve. It, as a kind of norm, it seems to me fine. But if we're talking about a degree of realism in our utopias, it's not realistic enough. And that leads me to some essays that Susan Mendes, a political theorist in England, has written, which are enclosed and perhaps not as expansive as they might be, but in which she develops the notion of neighborliness, more than toleration for the odious, as it were, but less than a kind of multicultural utopianism. And any of us who's lived in a block of flats knows something about neighborliness. We don't really know much about what goes on inside our neighbors' flats, provided there's a degree of public comity. We don't care what goes on in those flats. We're not in the game of deep recognition of the other. But it's more than just tolerating my neighbor whom I think is odious. So it's in that zone that I think we need to look. And one thing I hope to do next time is to talk about toleration in these terms of neighborliness as a kind of, to give the technical jargon, a kind of continuous set of variables. Toleration is a multi-layered concept. And I'd like to probe briefly what those different layers might be, and therefore the choices we might have to make or can make realistically amongst them. Now, to back up to first observations very briefly, Greeks, sure, I mean, but the Greek tradition, of which the amount of ignorance I could now display would be, you know, so profound as to empty the room in an instant, but my understanding is of a very narrow political community, of an intense democratic community, but not one characterized in the main by heterogeneity, pluralism, multiculturalism, or what have you. It is the source of various republican virtues, as well as flaws, including the militarization of citizenship and the like. But most profoundly for me, I would observe that after Locke, almost every major Republican thinker in France, De Stael and Constant, in America, Madison and Paine, for that matter, all move in liberal Lockean directions in their later works, away from purely Republican notions, on the same ground, the ground that the Republican tradition cannot manage plurality.
And here I think my friend Quentin Skinner's vision of republicanism versus liberalism couldn't be more wrong, that the modern liberal tradition often emerged out of the republican tradition when it came smack up against problems, including problems of heterogeneity and urbanism, that modern heterogeneity and urbanism, the products of market forces, capitalism, cultural pluralism, and the like, that the republican tradition simply could not deal with. Does liberalism produce more danger? Some of you will know Michael Mann has a really interesting new book on ethnic cleansing and democracy, just published by Cambridge Press. Mann says ethnic cleansing is the result of democracy. And he's right. But he says wrongly, in my view, that ethnic cleansing is new. It's simply a 19th and 20th century phenomenon. There were expulsions, after all, of the ones, for example, I spoke some centuries ago, and they were in part the product of proto-liberalism, because it was town governments using rights of representation that voted to expel their Jews. The first was Leicester under Simon de Montfort, who led the Montfortian revolt some 30 years later, that helps produce modern parliaments as liberal institutions. So there is an imbrication of which produces danger, but precisely what's interesting to me is given that danger, and we can't do without the liberal tradition. We have no other sphere today of ideas or institutions that can reciprocally manage such dangerous pluralism and render it decent. And so we are stuck one way or another with liberalism and the city. And finally, cities of the future and transaction costs. Well, we'd have to have a dialogue, for which we don't have time for now, about which transaction costs. Urban liberalism, it seems to me, is germane to barriers of multiple kinds, including economic barriers and markets, including population movements, including the movement of ideas. Yes, the liberal tradition is an accelerator of dynamism in each of those spheres by, in your language, reducing transaction costs. All the world, I said, is now a city, or cities, given this vast acceleration of markets, ideas, people. And that being the case, the challenges that were once simply isolated in very small towns, 1,000, 3,000, 5,000, 10,000 people on this island nearly a millennium ago, today are the problems of the entire issues and problems of the entire globe. So if we, I'm just really very superficially scratched the surface of a topic, liberalism and the city, but it is increasingly the topic, not just for cities of the future, but for the globe. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ira. Thank you very much. Can I remind you that we're going to meet again on Thursday? The plan is to have more discussion.
I'll be briefer.
Not that you'll be briefer, but that we'll discuss. But we have more discussion, and so look forward to seeing you all then. Thank you very much for coming.